Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
What we're trying to do is add value to what would typically be just a dairy animal. We're trying to add beef value to that animal and actually produce good quality beef at the end. So we're taking what would typically be a milk-producing animal, but naturally we would produce Holstein beef. Holsteins don't fit as well into the beef production system as our typical beef animals would.
Olivia Genther-Schroeder of Purina talks about some of the desired genetic traits focused on in beef dairy cattle crossbreeding.
So when we mix the genetics, we maintain really good things that come from the Holstein breed, which like marbling, but we bring in reduced days on feed and increased carcass yields that allow for an animal that is produced as a part of the dairy industry, but actually fits much better into the beef industry at the end of the day.
This is Agriculture Today.
Look, here's the real issue.
Richard Fisher, former chair of the Dallas Federal Reserve, right after the election last month.
So the U.S. government's revenue in fiscal year 2024, which just ended, is $4.92 trillion. Out of that, they spent $950 billion on interest on government debt.
Right.
And they spent $826 billion on defense. 2 points. One is no major power in history. You can go all the way back to the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Spain, Habsburgs, England. When they start paying more on interest on debt, then they become a declining power. That's historically proven. Second point, and I'd love to get Jim's view on this. Imagine a company that is a percentage of total sales or revenue spent 19.3% of their revenue on interest on their bonds. What company would survive that? None. So we're in this predicament. I haven't heard either candidate, Trump or Harris, discuss this. And I don't know, how does that make us safer democracy or make America great again when we're shoving out all that money to pay interest on government debt? And very importantly, we're rolling over 2% plus debt and now having to refinance it at 4.5 or 4 plus. So our interest bill is going to go up. We're in a world which is seriously troubled and threatened. We're paying more in interest again than we are in defense. And both of these candidates have proposed programs which ramp up the deficits and therefore are going to increase the interest burden even further. I'm very worried about it. And as Steve pointed out, the polls don't show much concern about this, but trust me, when the 10-year, which I thought was a great graph, if it were to be subject to bond vigilantes and go through 5%, 6%, 7%, we'll pay attention because it's going to hurt everybody. And it's going to hurt employment. It'll roll over into inflation. But my golly, we haven't heard either Trump or Harris talk about this issue except for proposing deeper deficits, more spending, higher interest costs.
Speaking on CNBC, he said the ship can be righted.
There are rays of sunshine, by the way, and I hope you'll forgive me for pointing this out. I live in Dallas. I'm a Texan.
What?
Texas,
no, you're like awful.
Texas's GDP Texas's GDP grew 6%, actually a little less than that, 5.8% in 2023. I'm now beginning to see Detroit, for example, embrace capital formation and becoming pro-business. If you're anti-business, like some of these New York, California, et cetera, people leave.
No, you're
right.
If you're
pro-business,
right.
People immigrate into them. Like
no, we like
massively.
Business people are the highest rated people in terms of honor and integrity in this country right now. We have
Jeff Sonnenfeld walking around back here. People are moving into New York City. New York City is not losing population. I'll take it when we deserve it, but we don't deserve it. New York City is doing well.
We got to grow out of
it. It's not so much corporate migration.
There's been some corporate migration. I'm just saying the people, the kids love it here.
Richard, California is not. We're seeing massive.
No, that's true.
My point is there are examples in the country, whether it's Texas or whether it's Utah or whether it's Michigan.
Huge swath of the country is good. Huge swath.
Yeah. Richard, and that's a good example, and I do think we'll find other people copying that, copying Florida, et cetera. And this will right itself, Jim, but it'll take a lot of time.
I agree with you.
We need to have responsible government.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Kirkland Feedyard started really right at 40 years ago.
Robbie Kirkland is with Kirkland Feedyards in Vega, Texas, chairman, Texas Cattle Feeders Association.
My dad, Perry, he bought a little feed yard to hold about 1,000 head, and we've just kind of grown it through the years. And so, I grew up there working with dad, working at the feed yard through high school and then through college. And then after finishing up at Texas Tech, I decided it was my passion to go back home and work with a family operation. That's kind of where we are now.
He says the industry does have challenges.
There are lots of challenges that face agriculture. I mean, agriculture in general faces challenges, it seems like. And most industries, you know, they probably can find their challenges as well. Within the cattle feeding sector and what we do, we'll kind of go through a few here, but one thing is that we talk about and just got back here representing Texas cattle feeders at the U.S. Cattle Trace symposium. Traceability is something that's a hot topic for the industry, and lots of different debates on both sides of it. So that's one issue that we talk about. We always want to, as far as an industry, be profitable. If you're not profitable, you can't be sustainable. That's the question we always get is, what does sustainability mean? And there's lots of different meanings to me and to the industry as far as sustainability. But for one, we have to be profitable to be sustainable. And that's not just the feeding sector. That's the cow calf to the stocker backgrounder to the feed yard and then on to the packing industry as well. And so, having a nice, strong, sustainable, profitable sector throughout the chain is always important.
But in spite of the challenges, there's opportunities. And he's optimistic.
Being agriculture, I've always said you have to be optimistic. You have to be an optimistic person because you're always having to look for that opportunity down the road. And for us, like I said, it's, we enjoy, we love what we do. We're a family operation, here. Carson, my son is back with us. Our nephew, Hunter, my dad, myself. And so, a lot of our family is able to join in this and work together. So that's always great. But we see opportunities, at the end of the day, we're providing a healthy, product, a healthy, sustainable, protein that people really like. And that's, that's a big thing for us and knowing that we're doing that in a healthy, wholesome way. But for us, what we do is working with customers, to feed cattle and the opportunity we see is helping those people make the most of what they're producing. And, that's something that kind of gets me up every day is working with those customers and feeders that are providing, for their families and their operations. And we're just trying to help them be more productive and more financially stable.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The second chart again is familiar, showing the debt to GDP ratio going off to infinity.
Earlier this year at an American Enterprise Institute event in Washington, D.C., director of the CBO, Philip Schwagel.
Promise it doesn't get better if you go past 30 years. And, we have now what we begin to call the 250% problem, which is, at some point, right, the debt to GDP ratio can get to a high enough value that you kind of have to look at it and think, really, is that is it meaningful at that point? And we've decided to truncate our y-axis now at 250% of GDP. So this one doesn't have it, but if you do a few negative shocks, then you can get a worse debt to GDP ratio. And of course, you can imagine negative shocks to both the numerator and the denominator, right? The deficit, the numerator being worse, so the debt being worse, and GDP being lower, so the denominator being worse as well. And then, you know, then you really face the 250% problem.
From the 250% problem to the fact we're walking on thin ice.
And of course, with more debt and higher interest rates, that means that we're more vulnerable to further shocks. And so CBO published an update to our rules of thumb workbook. This is an XLS spreadsheet on our website. And you can, you know, you basically use that to say, okay, what if I make changes to the CBO budget baseline, you know, whether, you know, generally to the economics. And so I did that. And you can show that 50 basis points of higher interest rates. So if the 10-year yield, if the yield on the 10-year treasury is 50 basis points higher than what CBO had in our last forecast, which was from December of last year, it comes out to an increase in the deficit of more than $1.6 trillion over the next 10 years. So it just gives you an indication of the sensitivity that we have in terms of the risk of a worse fiscal outcome.
Is there really good news?
So this is a chart that shows the change in the 10-year deficit outlook from the prior baseline, so from the 2023 baseline through what we put out in February of 2024. So from May 23 to February 24, and you can see that the 10-year deficit went down. There's a variety of changes in there. The biggest improvement came about because of the Fiscal Responsibility Act that was enacted by the Congress, signed by the President last year. So that reduced discretionary spending. It put caps on discretionary spending. Subsequent legislation, there's CRs, and then the full-year appropriations that essentially have embodied those caps with certain adjustments. By statute, CBO projects forward discretionary spending. Right? So we make no assumption about what a future Congress will do. By statute, there's a mechanical rule projecting discretionary spending forward. Using that mechanical rule, that gives you the legislative changes. So it says there, it's at $2.6 trillion. So the FRA was 2.5 of it.
Then there's something known as green tax provisions.
The last line is the technical changes, and that a large part of that is re-estimated costs of the green tax provisions in the 2022 reconciliation bill. And again, that work was done by the Joint Committee on Taxation. The re-estimates were also done by the Joint Committee on Taxation. And it looks like those costs are going to be much higher than was originally estimated. So that in some sense offset some of the budgetary improvement, but on net, from baseline to baseline, there's an improvement.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There's about 4,600 banks in the United States, and community banks represent 97% of those 4,600 banks.
Mark Scanlon is Senior Vice President of Ag and Rural America with the Independent Community Bankers of America.
We have about 70 to 75% of banks, community banks in rural areas. They provide about 80% of the farm real estate loan financing and 75% of the farm operating debt. So they're very big in terms of the agricultural scene and in terms of how much they contribute from the overall banking community to farmers and ranchers and our rural citizens in rural America. They provide a very vital link because they are high touch type of operations. They know their customers. Many cases they've known them for many years and walk in the door and greet each other on a first name basis. So I think they play a very vital role. They're very important in ensuring that farmers and ranchers and others in rural America have access to financing, which is very important to keep their operations going.
He says ag lending requires unique knowledge regarding each individual borrower.
No, it's very technical in many cases. And, you know, with agriculture, it can be a very cyclical business. And it's also impacted by forces that are beyond our control with adverse weather that's unpredictable. And so you kind of, you know, have to know what's gone on before and what to expect. And agriculture operates with very tight margins. So, you know, you need to be aware of what you're doing as a banker in order to be able to help customers that are operating on thin margins. And there's a variety of different types of customers, from young farmers to many that have been in business for decades. So, you know, you have to know the business model that they're operating under and kind of what their situation is. So that's where the high touch, you know your customer type of relationship is very vital.
What are the priorities for ICBA in the next legislative session?
You know, the farm bill, if they do extend it for another year as expected, then I would also expect that they will come back early next year and maybe have a few hearings. I don't think they need as many hearings as they've on this new farm bill, because they've already had a lot. So I think they could go through a committee process where they pass a new bill. And the good thing about that is the text has already been written with the House Ag Committee's farm bill, and the Senate has been working on text as well. So I think they could pass bills out of those, out of the House and Senate Ag Committees fairly soon in the next year. So that maybe by spring or early summer, you're having a farm bill that is marching towards the floor and getting passed. So I think they could act relatively quickly on that. I would say also the tax package coming out of, extend the tax cuts. I think that will be one of the first big bills out of the gate as well. And we're certainly supportive of that. And there's a lot in those, in the tax package for agriculture as well. So those two issues will be, I think, early out of the gate in 2025.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
One thing is always good about our convention in San Antonio is it draws a huge crowd.
Ben Weinheimer is president and CEO of Texas Cattle Feeders Association, recalling the recent convention for cattle feeders in San Antonio.
People really excited to come together, get updates on various issues and of the day, hear some great presentations, and have an opportunity to socialize with their peers. And so we sure enough accomplished that, had a great lineup of speakers, started off by hearing from our chairman, Gene Lowry, update from Colin Woodall with NCBA, couple of interesting presentations, one by Chad Hymas, who was paralyzed a number of years ago in a hay bale incident, and he really shares his life story and the inspirational elements, you know, that people can hopefully take home and learn from that experience and apply that to their everyday lives. Rounded out our convention with, some insights on artificial intelligence. So Tom Edwards, as an expert in that space, shared his thoughts and ideas with us, and finished up really with a couple of one more of a perennial presenter hearing from Cattle Facts. And this year we had Mike Murphy on the program. So great insights as always. And then our anchor for the convention was Damon John, co-star of Shark Tank, and really cool to hear his story. Definitely a rags to riches type of presentation, and inspirational all in and of itself. So great convention, had a great time. Our folks were excited to be there and looking forward to what's ahead for the coming year.
Now, the chairman of the Texas Cattle Feeders Association is Robbie Kirkland from Vega, Texas.
I mean, that's something that we truly believe, is giving back. And that's a huge, you know, we're at Thanksgiving here. We're at, the month of giving. And, that's something that's really huge. And I think today the number is that the Texas cattle feeder region, which would be Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, is providing, they're producing a third of the U.S. country, our country's beef in the United States. And So that's, that in itself says a lot. And like you said, the feeding industry, the agriculture industry in these communities are huge. I mean, that's what helps support, you know, all the things that are going on. I mean, along with all the other industries, but they're always reaching out, trying to help, you know, whether it's the school or whether it's your churches and whatever's going on within the, within these communities. It's a very, economic driver for our region. And, that's something that I always say is we have to work within ourselves and help and kind of, let's see the right word, but I always say that it's big to start right there, you know, within your family and then within your community and then within your state and your region. And you have to, you know, be the ones that are there providing and helping for whatever needs it is. We talk about this at TCFA, at Texas Cattle Feeders, about our relationship with, the High Plains Food Bank and Snack Pack for Kids and things like that, where we're, you know, providing beef and, you know, beef sticks and dollars that go in and help feed our region and these communities.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Of course, the surge of immigration means a larger labor force, and that's what's shown in the chart, and that contributes to GDP.
The issue of immigration was a hot topic during the recent election. But earlier this year, speaking at an AEI event in Washington, D.C., Philip Schwagel, director of the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO.
Our initial tally that we did for the February baseline was at about, there's about a $7 trillion impact on GDP, this is a nominal GDP, over the budget window. And that translated, according to our models, into about $1 trillion of additional revenues, again, over the budget window. Some of the outlay impacts were already in the budget baseline. Right? Anything through the tax code, there's a delay in most immigrants in eligibility for many of the federal benefits. But things through the tax code, if a new immigrant coming through the surge, such as someone who comes in through humanitarian parole, they generally have work authorization within a year. Many of them get it at 6 months, and then many others soon thereafter. And so someone who gets, say a federal benefit through the tax code, whether it's the tax benefit for employer sponsored insurance or a tax credit, right? That's in the baseline already. You know, that we've got. There's other things though that we're working on now. So for example, many immigrants have a multi-year period before they're eligible for certain benefits. So for example, Medicaid, there's generally a 5-year waiting period for many of the immigrants coming in through the surge before they're eligible for most Medicaid benefits. There's certain ones, emergency ones, that, there's reimbursement sooner, but for the most part, there's a 5-year delay. And that varies by the type of immigrant, you know, meaning which program they come in, and then which benefit. So that's the work that we're doing now, and that I'm hopeful that we're gonna, have in the spring baseline and put out lots of material with that, is what are the outlay implications of the surge of benefits? The surge of immigration, the outlay impacts of the surge of immigration. And just to say a little bit about CBO process, well, if you think about it, what's the cost, the cost of Medicaid to an immigrant 7 years from now, or an immigrant who arrived in 2022, 6 years after, so in 2028, 4 years from now, right? To know that, well, you have to know, well, what's the income of that immigrant, because Medicaid is means tested, and you also have to know, well, which state are they in, because the eligibility for Medicaid varies by expansion and non-expansion states in the Affordable Care Act. So that's the work we're doing, is making projections, from today going forward, or from 2022 going forward, from the surge going forward, of the income impacts and the distributional impacts of the surge of immigration. We're working as well on the productivity impacts. Of course, some of the immigrants will start companies. They'll, you know, they'll learn. They'll contribute knowledge. They'll have patents. There'll be effects on long-term GDP. We're looking at that. We're looking at the impacts on GDP and on inflation. And of course, immigration affects both supply and demand. It affects labor supply, as I discussed, but it also affects demand. Immigrants buy things. And, in a sense, the immigration surge helped loosen the tight labor market, but also contributed to demand. So that we're looking at the balance between those two.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, I think you can just talk about the resiliency and the opportunity that we have.
Leslie Oden with the National Turkey Federation.
Our membership, from the growers to the processors, we constantly punch above our weight time and time again. And that when our backs are in the corner, you want us there, because we will stand up to the challenges and we'll meet those demands and we'll overcome these significant challenges that we have ahead of us. I think there is a tremendous amount of opportunity that we have to increase that consumption further and bring great products safely and efficiently as best we can. But for us, you know, whether you're going to roast a whole turkey next week or a turkey breast, turkey's a versatile protein that you should incorporate in your everyday life. And we just hope that you will choose our great product.